that will be coming out around the end of the year.
This is Ken Freeland, facilitator of the 9/11 Truth teleconference. The following is the special 9/11 Truth teleconference for August 17th, 2014, with Niels Herod. Unfortunately, due to a software glitch, the only comments you will not hear are my own as facilitator. So there will be slight gaps where I am speaking, but it will not interfere with your ability to hear questions posed by participants and answers from Niels Herod. Present on the call were Lawrence Fine, Barbara Holliger, Art Olivier, Dwayne Dietz, James Hufford, David Schlesinger, Ned Delaney, Barton Bruce, in addition to myself and Niels Herod, our guest of honor. The question that I asked him later in the broadcast, which you will not hear, but to which you will be responding, was why were so many of the thermitic materials unreacted? But other than that, you will hear the questions posed by the individual participants and Neil's responses.
Okay, I will ask a question. I don't think it came up last time. Mm-hmm. It pertains to figure 30 in the paper. And it is a plot of energy by mass. This is a question that I remember that T. Mark Hightower raised at some point, and it was the he considered to be a wide variation between the four chips that were measured. So do you know what that issue is, Neil?
Yeah, obviously, this is energy per mass. And the chips that you weigh are very small, and they are different. And that's what it is. And these four chips were different. So they gave off a different amount of energy. And they are rather small. So just to weigh them is connected with a great deal of uncertainty. And that's it. I mean, I don't see if that is an... I don't see the point. These four chips were different.
So I guess my question is, was that unexpected to have such a variation between the chips? I guess my thought is if they were manufactured, which I guess they would be as nanothermite, I would think they would be more regular,
you have the gray layer along as well, and the ratio of red layer to gray layer is accidental. This material has been through some rough treatment, should we say, put it that way, and whatever remains of the red layer is what do you say? I missed the proper English word for it, but it's up to chance how much red layer there would be left on the chip, okay? And we didn't expect anything. You are not supposed to expect anything when you make a measurement.
Okay. No, I'll just leave it at that. I just would say I would have expected it to be more regular being manufactured, but maybe it was damaged in the event. I don't know. I just don't have a good feel for it.
Okay. They were very small. I don't remember exact how big these chips were, but so the simply way off is connected with a great amount of uncertainty. Yeah, maybe okay. You have a point.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I'm still kind of formulating, though. I think I'd like to pass for now and come back to me.
Sorry, I wasn't at the last session. My friend Wayne Costi has been making the very simple argument against mini nukes that it would have been deafening. There would have been a single huge spike in the sound level. Does that make sense to you, Niels?
Well, the bottom line is here, you cannot have a nuclear event without radioactivity. And there wasn't any. It's as simple as that. If you blow an atomic bomb, the area will become pretty radioactive. And we are talking about radioisotopes, radioactive material. And there wasn't any. So that's it. But it's perfectly right. I guess an atomic bomb will make a hell of a lot of a noise. That's correct.
Were people testing for radioactivity? Who was testing for it?
The Lawrence... Wait.
Lawrence Livermore?
No, Paul Lyoy did that. Paul Lyoy. He was in charge of the investigation of the dust. I think I have the paper somewhere, and he has even written a book called The Dust. You know, Paul Lyoy?
Spell it. Spell his name, please.
Lioy, Paul. He's written a book called The Dust, and it's 250 pages, but throughout these, you know, they haven't discovered the iron spheres. He was in charge of the official dust investigation and also the famous paper in 2002 where they were later actually where they falsified the dusts. You know the Kate Jenkins story? But Paul Lyoy did that. There is an official... I can't find it right now. I have the paper somewhere here. There is an official report, and there's absolutely zero radioactivity in the dust. Stephen E. Jones also tested the dust for any radioactivity, and he's a nuclear scientist, as you know, and they did it very thoroughly, and there simply isn't any. And then there's a story about the tritium in the basement of the World Trade Center 6, on which there also has been a report, but we are talking about marginal values here, just above the noise level. And if this should be put down simply, you cannot flush a hydrogen bomb down the toilet. Put it that way. And you cannot have Fukushima broken openly in the south tip of Manhattan.
One more question.
Can I ask a question now? It's
yes,
Barbara.
Please. Barbara?
Yeah, at the an event in Boston, which was probably the one that Barbara had an idea about, throwing the Kane Commission into the harbor, a fellow named Larry Patriarca, who's from Worcester, was raising an issue with Richard, claiming he's in favor of the mini-nuke theory, and his argument was that the electrical wiring in the building that Jeanette McKinley lived in was so damaged that it took him an extra 2 years to fix the electrical wiring. And I don't know why that would imply mini-nukes, but I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about what would be the significance of the electrical wiring being destroyed?
Well, the point that he tries to make here is that a nuclear bomb, when it detonates, it gives off an electromagnetic pulse, which is so high, so enormous that it simply shortcuts any integrated circuitry, electrical circuitry in the neighborhood. It means that all electrical apparatus in Manhattan would have simply been blown out of operation if you had had a nuclear event there. And that is what this electrician apparently recognized in Jeanette McKinley's building. But it would have also happened to all electric apparatus, all cell phones, all computers, all hard drives, all everything. It simply had gone out. And it didn't happen. So if you suspect there should be an elephant in the room, there should be some leftovers. And this is one of the, you cannot, and one very funny, actually, consequence of this is that, you know, the South Tower went down first. Now, if that was a nuclear event, it would have been impossible to take down the North Tower by the same procedure because none of the electric circuits would have functioned. So there's a humorous aspect to this as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, if you can hear me. I didn't come with any specific ones. I was planning to listen, but I was getting onto Skype troubles, and then inject a question if there was something really relevant popped up from the discussion.
Yeah? We don't know. Honestly, I don't know. Maybe it's being blown away from the reaction zone by the reacting material. I don't know. Or it was sticking to the inside of the envelope of the container. I don't know. If it is
so
much,
I should go ahead. Whatever.
We don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I would. There are a couple of images that I've grabbed off of the web of the sub-basement, well into the bedrock, underneath the towers, appear to be an anomaly, almost as though the rock was... It almost appears as though the rock may have been vaporized. Is anyone familiar with these images?
No, but some of the rock had melted.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Maybe some of the rock had melted. Is that what you're referring to?
It appears to be more than melted. There are pockets. There are, like, voids.
Yeah. Well, and there are similar observations, definitely, from the R.J. Lee Group report on the dust samples. And also, no, I think it was in the United States Geological Survey report from 2005, when they had found silicate, which also looked like Swiss cheese. And that means that the silicate had been boiling.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, silicate. It's an ingredient of stone.
Yes.
It's not graphite. It's a kind of stone. But this silicate had apparently been boiling. There are some pictures in the USGS report, and also, I believe, in the paper published by Stephen E. Jones, what was in 2007, called Extremely High Temperatures.
Yes.
And that means that we are in a temperature range beyond 3,000 degrees centigrade.
Right.
I cannot remember the exact numbers, but this is very high. Also, we found... There was a molybdenum spherules found, and molybdenum has a much higher melting point than iron. I believe, as I recall, it's about 2,800 degrees centigrade. I don't know how much that is in Fahrenheit. So we are dealing here with temperatures, and there was boiling lead. This is solid. This is very nice. So we are dealing with temperatures which are beyond an ordinary iron oxide thermite reaction can produce ever. It's a mysterious. Maybe, you know, thermite is a generic name for a whole range of materials and mixtures. And one of the most efficient is with molybdenum oxide and copper.
Yep.
And using those, you can approach temperatures of 4,000 degrees centigrade.
Holy smoke.
And we don't know. We have only this finding of this molybdenum sphere, which was reported by USGS. I believe it was in their report. But nobody has been looking for it. We haven't been looking for them. You know, it's not magnetic. So it doesn't come up when you pull a magnet through the dust.
Understand.
So there are still many things we do not understand. But definitely, melting the bedrock in the basement of the towers is within reach for the thermite incendiaries.
Thank you very much, Nils.
You're welcome.
Yes. Thanks, Nils. I hope we can have more than one round because I'm going to forget some of my questions. But one of the main ones is, I have two to begin with. When you did your own analysis of the dust for your famous paper and any other analyses that you've done that you haven't published or that you were involved in any way, personally, did you test for, and if so, did you find any of the elements or isotopes of the element that Jeff Prager lists in his paper as being signatures of a fission reaction? That's number one. And number two...
Well, let me take that first. The answer is
okay.
No.
Okay, all right.
The answer is no.
Well, did you look or did you not find?
I didn't look, so I didn't find.
Why didn't you look? I'm just curious.
Barbara, this is radioactivity. All you have to do is go into a store, buy a cheap Geiger counter, and hold it in front of the sample, and it will go mad.
Yes, I know that. I know you've said that many times, Neil. But let me try it this way. Prager claims, and I'm not advocating for him. I'm asking, and the reason I'm asking again and again is because I know that Duane Dietz has asked a question. In the email, I'm not sure it's been answered yet, and I'd appreciate hearing that answer too. Prager notes, and I'd like to know if you agree with him, Prager notes or claims that in a fission reaction, that certain elements, like I believe it was barium and strontium, and uranium and thorium is another pair, as I recall, that they're going to be paired, that they're going to correlate together, and that for instance, the barium and the strontium are paired almost 100% correlation. How do you explain these correlations, number one, and how do you explain what he claims, anyway, to be elements that only appear in their radioactive form, uranium and thorium, for instance? How would you explain that?
The last thing is simply not correct. It's a lie.
I couldn't hear you. What?
No, you're saying that uranium and thorium only appeared in the radioactive form. It is not correct. It is simply not correct. And the
okay,
other
that,
thing
you made that
about,
point. Uh-huh.
Yeah, about the elements, No, I do. I have no explanation. I haven't looked at the numbers, and there's no reason to do that. With you cannot have a nuclear event without radioactivity. Ask the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and of the Chernobyl and Fukushima. Ask them if you can have a nuclear reaction without radioactivity, and the answer is no. So it is all
okay. So Niels, the answer that they give to that, and they've heard you say that, the answer they give to that, and I'd like to know your answer back. Not because I don't believe you, but because people ask me. Their answer back to your statement that, well, there would be radioactivity, is that those were very old generation nuclear weapons, and that since then, there have been higher generation nuclear weapons. They call them third generation nuclear weapons and higher, that have extremely low levels of radioactivity, that they're engineered not to have it, number one. And their second answer is, well, they were extremely small micro-nukes, mini or micro-nukes, that are third or higher generation would have the levels of radioactivity that you're claiming. How do you answer that?
What is the evidence? When you're talking about these elements in certain ratios and correlated to each other, you're referring to an ordinary old-fashioned fission reaction of uranium-235 and plutonium. And they have to die out after I don't know how many years, the half-lives of tens of years. Maybe you'll find elements in that ratio. So there's a contradiction here. If Mr. Prager,
okay,
whoever it is, let me finish. What is the evidence? If you say that there is, you do not expect to find any evidence, that's your claim. You're saying there is no evidence because there's not supposed to be any, and that is the proof. I mean, that is a zero times zero, and it makes zero. You get my point? This person, Prager, he says you are not supposed to find if we ask what is the evidence, he says there is not supposed to be any. All right. Yeah, so it's a bit thin, isn't it? It's ridiculous.
All right. Well, so if I can try to say back to you what you've just said to see if I understand it. I think what you're saying is the answer to those claims that there isn't radioactivity because they are higher generation nuclear weapons that don't have radioactivity. Your answer back, I believe, that I just heard, was those particular combinations of correlations of elements that Prager cites are, to your understanding or knowledge, only for first generation, like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But they are not the correlations that are for higher generation, third generation, or higher nuclear weapons. Do you know that to be true?
Listen, for once, I have not looked into these elemental ratios because there's no reason for doing it. And we only have these people's word that there is a correlation. I mean, and strontium can come from, there's plenty of strontium in the primer paint. Barium you could get from the from thermate. Zinc also is present in the primer paint. Chromium is abundant in the primer paint, etc., etc. If you want, we must have a scientific study of these elements, and it must be published before it is worth the discussion.
Let me finish.
Okay, look, please recognize that now we are talking about something none of us know anything about, because somebody is waving her hands and saying this is a third generation nuclear bomb which does not give radioactivity. Now, what is it? Nobody knows. So we're sitting here in a discussing something none of us knows anything about. Okay?
Okay. One other point then. I just want to clarify that when you say that there's no data We're talking about the data from the government's own U.S. Geological Survey report.
I don't know. Was that a question?
Well, you had said that there's no data, that we're not that these correlations of the elements like barium and strontium, that's from the USGS report itself.
So why should that be indicative of a third generation nuclear weapon?
I don't know. That's my question to you. Is it or not?
None of us knows. That's the point.
No, I think that you're misunderstanding what Prager's saying, but I still, well, let me ask you this. Niels, have you read Prager's paper?
Well, I have read, I read some of Don Fox, and I read some of Tim Fetzer. I don't remember if the authors on this stuff.
But okay, I would hope that you would read Prager, because his work is based on the U.S. Geological Survey's own data. And then Don Fox does not have the knowledge or analytical ability of Prager. And I have one last question. For laymen, for people on the street who ask you about it, they simply cannot believe that the massive upward thrust and massive outward horizontal thrust that they see in that volcano-like eruption, explosion of the tower. They cannot believe that any grade of explosive, any amount of explosive nanothermite could have created that. How do you answer that?
Well, you were in Toronto, Barbara. Did you hear my presentation in Toronto?
Yes, of course.
Okay, you got the answer there. If you care to watch the collapses of the Twin Towers, and I have done that more than 1,000 times, it's true, because I'm giving presentations on the World Trade Center, and I show for each tower at least the collapse 3 or 4 times, and I have given this presentation more than 200 times. And including preparation, it's more between 1,000 and 2,000 times I've been watching the collapses of the Twin Towers. And I'm still amazed how obvious, how clean, it's all there. Every fragment which is being thrown out from the Twin Towers carry after them a completely homogeneous white smoke trail. Now, what do you think that is? Is that wallboard?
No.
Is that concrete?
No.
Don Fox claimed that it was boiling steel. But that was after it was cut off, man. So what is it? It's aluminum oxide. Straight. And that is the second product from the thermite reaction. And this is where the nanothermite fits in quite nicely, actually. Okay? So it is not... And I, in my presentation, if you had grasped that, I was laying out the difference between an incendiary and an explosive and a propellant, rocket fuel. Because what, in my opinion, we're dealing with here is something in between. And you can see these fragments coming out of the Twin Towers, accelerating to the ground at 11 meters per second squared. This is faster than free fall. Now, come on. How can something fall faster than free fall? It cannot unless you fire a rocket to the ground. You see fragments coming out of the South Tower, changing direction 90 degrees. It's completely ridiculous. You see fragments coming out and continuing fragmentation in air, exploding in air. If you care to look, so it's all obvious. These are explosives. It's downright I would not say old-fashioned chemistry, but there is no new hocus-pocus fantasy materials, mini-nukes, space beams, directed energy. It is all chemistry. It's all easily understood within the framework which has been operating in science for 250 years.
Right, but the question is, can nanothermite account for it?
Pardon?
But the question was, yes, we know all that, but can nanothermite account for it? That amount of energy upwards and outwards?
Yes.
Well, you don't know that. I mean, we should not carry this speculation beyond the data. What do we have? We have more than 10 independent observations for the occurrence of thermitic reactions in one form or the other. Some are contradictory, like finding of the sulfidized steel by Jonathan Barnett of the Worcester Institute of Technology. The red gray chips cannot account for that. There's no sulfur in there. But so probably the beams were cut by thermite, and there you have the source of the barium, if you wish, because barium and sulfur is traditional additive in the thermite material, which cuts through steel. I could explain that if we had the time, but that's what it does. But the red gray chips cannot account for that. But then you have some observations, and I could make a list, and then you find this material in the dust, and that is it. Of course, we do not have big samples. We cannot make the red gray chips. We can make something which very much looks like it. We understand the principles behind its preparation. There's no hanky-panky there. It is nanoscience, it's nanochemistry, which has been around since the early 90s. So we understand.
Okay, so is a layman's interpretation or summary of what you just said that you believe that the evidence, the observations that we have, support nanothermite and something else?
Yes, thermite and an explosive. We don't know. Obviously, explosives are in operation here. Explosives are doing work. Incendiary cannot work. Incendiaries can only make heat. But explosives are not particularly energetic. And Dwayne brought up this picture, actually, from figure 30 from the nanothermite paper. And people are saying, well, there's more energy in burning, if you was burning wood. And that's correct. The point, people think that explosives are particularly energetic. They are not. The point is they are fast. That is the key, what you say, property of explosives. It is a very fast reaction, developing a gas, so they can do work. They can move things, and they can break things apart. So obviously, just watch. There were explosives which blew up the Twin Towers. And we do not know what these explosives were. They might have been what we call molecular explosives, old-time explosives, like RDX, stuff like that. Or they might have been thermitic in origin. We do not know.
Well, did you look in the dust for evidence of explosives?
No, we didn't. No, not the regular explosives. You have a whole range of, like, TNT and RDX and stuff like that, and you can buy a kit. My guess is that they would be all gone by now, and after 5 years. And no, we didn't look for it. No, we didn't.
Uh-huh.
To my knowledge, nobody has.
No, I'm...
I guess I'm ready. Neil,
yeah.
How familiar are you with the attempt to replicate your findings by a study supposedly ongoing by a chemical engineer named Mark Bazile? Are you familiar with that?
Well, I know that something is happening, but I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I just wondered if you had any knowledge or opinion of that study.
Well, to be honest, if this has happened 4 years ago,
uh-huh,
I would have been ecstatic. I would have been very glad.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, I still had a belief in academia, and I had a belief in society, and I had a belief that an investigation like this could happen without being interfered with. But considering how things has developed in the last years, I don't know. Anything can happen. It's very vulnerable, you can buy the state of academia now, which is what I know best. I don't know about independent laboratories in the United States, but I know in academia, I mean, you can buy any result, any opinion out there. And I'm actually surprised the American government hasn't done that long time ago, which because you cannot find an academic American institution which is not depending on federal funding these days. And so they had a squeeze on all of them. So they could actually buy anything if they wished. And the fact that this hasn't happened yet maybe is the best indication that we are on some track, which may not be the right track, but if you go down that track, you might even find something else, which is more sinister. And considering quotation marks, independent labs, I don't know. I think you could put a squeeze on anybody these days. I told you, if this has happened 4 years ago, I would still be naive enough to believe that there could ever be an independent investigation. But now, to be honest, I don't know. But Mark is an honest man. Let me emphasize this. He's a very, very good guy.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you.
I'm just curious. Is the argument that a mini nuke would imply, because it would hit only once per tower, that there would have been no squibs as a result? So the existence of squibs would imply no mini nukes.
No,
is that fair?
Well, hi, David. The scenario of one bomb per tower contradicts what you see. As I told you, I have watched this video thousands of times, literally, and there are, excuse me, thousands of explosions occurring in a tightly timed schedule. And so there are no mini nukes there. It's more than a red herring. You know, in Danish we have something called a death herring. And a dead herring is something which is very, very dead.
Really?
I know you have a saying called a red herring, but in Danish we have a dead herring, and this is what I would call the mini nukes thing.
Hi, not at this point, thanks, Ken.
Yes, I would. It's looking for just a little bit more insight into the unknown. Since Thermate is no longer a secret, but there's a lot of secret stuff around it. Just looking for a reaffirmation about its potential as an explosive agent also.
Yeah. Well, what you have to do is you have to throw in something which can develop a gas. actually, it's enough to use Teflon. I have an echo now. Do you have an echo on me?
Yes, that's it.
Okay, maybe.
And I can't understand what is coming through at that point.
The Danish intelligence, they're not too clever. So they're probably messing this up. But if you put nano aluminum into Teflon, you know, the plastic you have on your frying pan, you actually get a quite efficient explosive. At least you have a serious reaction. But if you add iron oxide to the mix, that is, and this is, maybe some of you have seen Kevin Ryan making nanothermite in his backyard. And what he did there was he used, it's all embedded in a polymer, plastic. And what he used there was a plastic with fluorine in it. And let us call it Teflon. It was not Teflon, but let's call it Teflon. So you embed the aluminum and the iron oxide in a Teflon matrix. And what happened, you could see there that it blew off the tip of the beaker when he heated it up. And this is because, not because it gets hot, but because the aluminum loves the fluorine. So it goes to the fluorine, meaning that the oxygen from the iron oxide, it gets free to react with the carbon, and you have carbon dioxide develop as a gas. So now the nanothermite can actually do work, and we are on our way to making an explosive. And to make a serious explosive, you have to add other things, I guess. Please accept this concept of if you produce a gas, you can do work, and this is what explosives do. Let me mention in passing that if I remember correctly, the second step in the rocket which took the space shuttles into space is operating on a mixture of aluminum and ammonium nitrate. And this is not exactly a thermite reaction, but it is kind of a thermite reaction. Just to show that this aluminum reaction can do work. Obviously, it's not an explosive, because then the whole thing would blow apart. But it's a propellant, it's rocket fuel, which is intermediate between incendiaries and explosives. But it's what you have to, if you want to use the thermite reaction and convert the energy, there's a lot of energy in the thermite mixture. If you want to convert that to doing work, you have to add something which develops a gas. And somebody has been out there suggesting that you actually could throw RDX into the mix. And that's a pretty good suggestion. Because RDX is developing a gas very, very quickly, very, very efficiently, and actually making a lot of noise. But again, we do not know what kind of explosives were used for the demolition of the Twin Towers and Building 7. I mean, if I had to do this, imagine. Do you ever think of these people at work? Now I have an echo again. I wait. I try. I have.
Your voice is doubling up. We can't hear it, or I can't.
Yeah. How about now?
That's okay.
Yes.
No, I'm just, quite often I fancy how these people, how they were doing on Monday night. I mean, what they had to do, they had to blow up 3 high rises, and it was a task, with an achievement which has never been done before in history. Building 7 was at that time 30% higher than any skyscraper which had ever been demolished at that time. And the Twin Towers were 3 times higher than anything. Would you rely on a new invention? You know, and they had to blow up these towers while 1 billion people were watching in real time without anyone recognizing what actually was going on. There were no rehearsals. There were no retakes. There were no, hey, let's try it once again. Let's do it all over again. I mean, did they sleep? What would you do? Would you rely on some new fancy technology which had never been tested under the circumstances? No. You would go, you would rely on the good old stuff which you had used so many times, and after all the calculations were done, you would throw in 50% over capacity to make sure that they came down. And this is what you see overdoing. Regarding Building 7, ordinary demolitions do not come down in freefall for that simple reason that the commercial companies, they want to save on the explosives, obviously, so they have gravity doing as much as possible of the work. But in this case, this, they simply had to come down. So it's coming down in straight freefall. Some say it's almost freefall. No, 7 is coming down in straight, absolutely straight freefall. Actually, it's a little bit on the high side, which we do not understand. But that's an academic footnote, okay? So did you? How did they sleep on Monday night? No, they didn't. This is one of the seven wonders of the world, and they have never been praised for it. Probably they didn't get a chance actually to get praised. But it's a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece, absolutely.
It's a masterpiece. No rehearsals. 1 billion watching. It's a dream of any magician to take down 3 skyscrapers without anyone noticing. They would not rely on some fancy new stuff. They would throw in the good old stuff which they have used for probably tens of years ago.
Try to stay back in layman's terms, which is what we have to talk to people in. I believe that a summary of what you have told us is that from the evidence, the nanothermite, we know nanothermite was used, and that was used in a conventional way to cut the column and to let gravity do that work. But you're also saying that you're certain that there was explosive material. You just don't know what it is, and you did not look for it and therefore did not find it, and do not know anyone else who actually, including the government, the USGS or Lawrence Livermore, that no one to your knowledge actually looked in the dust samples, any of them, for explosives and found explosives.
That's correct.
Okay. That's such a difficult answer to give to people, that nobody looked for explosives, and yet we're claiming they're explosives.
Well, you know, NIST claims that there is no reason to look for something which isn't there. That's how they reason. It's on print. You can go to the frequently asked questions on their website. No, we did not look for explosives. Because there's no need to look for something which isn't there.
Right, but why didn't you look for explosives, your team?
Many things I haven't done. And it's not as simple as that, because what you're doing, you're looking for a specific material. And so it's guessing, you know?
Uh-huh.
Maybe this is that you make an analysis for a specific material. It's not that easy.
So you're saying if at the time you did your analysis, your team, you would have had to specifically look for elements of RDX?
No, I would have to look for RDX, and it probably
right,
would. I have reason to believe. I believe it would be gone at that time.
Yeah.
This material, they have a vapor pressure. They simply boil off very slowly, though, but they would be gone. I mean, it's not worth the effort. If somebody else wants to do it, fine with me. There are many things I haven't done. I mean, and yeah. So don't blame me for what I haven't done, Barbara.
Is there, well, no, I know that, but is there evidence beyond the evidence in the videotapes for an explosive substance like RDX that can do work?
No.
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 But if you care to watch, you can see the explosives at work. So the evidence...
I know that there are explosions. It's just people want to know what was the explosive that was used.
This we don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody has come up with a qualified guess of what the explosives are. We don't know.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. when he was talking about that, they wanted to make sure that they used a well-known explosive to make sure that it worked. I'm thinking that possibly that's why we see so much unexploded nanothermite we may have had some extra, but they put too much in. And I would think that they would want to use almost every new technology that they have for destroying buildings with a lot of different backups. That's just my opinion. But the question I have is with the cars that were exploding as people were walking by. Patricia Ondrovich, she was an EMT, and she was talking about after she left Building 6 that these cars were blowing up. And you see pictures of these cars where the engines are blowing up, but where the gas tank is at, the car is still intact. And it seems like what was ever blowing up the engines... that maybe the iron blocks and the engines had something to do with them blowing up, just like with the steel frame of the buildings just kind of crumbling into nothing. I was just wondering if Niels has any idea what would make those cars car engines blow up.
Well, I haven't seen any certified evidence of what you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
What I've seen is toasted cars. I've seen the roofs of cars being toasted and corroded.
Uh-huh.
The roofs, and without the seats being burned out. But this is obviously reacting thermite being thrown out of the towers. It has been said often that the dust clouds were pyroclastic, and maybe people do not know what that means, but it simply means that they were hot. Hot dust clouds. Pyros is Greek for fire, and clastic means that they're expanding. So these are hot dust clouds, and the point being that you don't see those except around volcanoes. You don't see pyroclastic clouds from ordinary building demolitions. You see some air being blown out and some crushed concrete, but you don't see hot dust clouds. So this is the thermite, this is the fallout from the thermite falling on the roof of the car standing next to the towers. And they were still reacting. People got burnt on their skin also. I haven't heard about any engines blowing up.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, another guy was Robert Ruiz, another EMT. You know, and he talked about these cars just, you know, being engulfed in fire, but these people never talked about them feeling any discomfort from any excessive heat. Just that you know, these cars that they were walking right past them would just catch on fire. Or someone would jump up and turn upside down, and so it was just kind of an amazing phenomenon.
I know. Well. If cars were turned upside down, it probably means that somebody had turned them upside down. But what all these observations, I mean, we should be careful and not to let fantasy run too fast. What is solid observations, okay?
Yeah, well, these is just you know, I always like to listen to the people that were actually there. And I don't think they have any reason to lie, and you know, and it's kind of backed up from the photographic evidence too. So
no.
I guess I've got a comment and a question, maybe. The comment is that I think Barbara was the one that was referring to what Jeff Prager had written. Jeff is not a physicist. He's not a scientist. He relies on a physicist by the name of Christopher Busby. And I just looked up on Wikipedia about Busby. And so I'm asking if, I'll go ahead and say what it says. Busby obtained a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry with first class honors from the University of London. His membership in the Royal Society of Chemistry lapsed in 1984. He later gained a PhD in chemical physics at the University of Kent, researching Raman spectroelectrochemistry. Okay, so the question is, Niels, do you know of this person?
No.
Okay, well, anyway, he's the one that is basically, well, one of the things he talks about is the new technology, third generation, whatever it is, in Fallujah, that was used in Fallujah, that allowed, maybe it was depleted uranium ordinances that were designed to, let's say, produce a radiation level that's lower than what the international standards were for where things had to be carefully controlled. I don't know whether any of that's true, but that's where he is coming from. So that's all I'll say on that. The other, it's a question about Building 7. There is a TV image of it coming down that's taken from across the river from the New Jersey side.
Of 7?
Is that the Building 7. And, okay. And what it shows is a massive cloud above it.
No?
That the commentator says it looks like the collapse of an active volcano. My question is, have you seen that image, that video?
No, interesting.
Yeah,
so that means that if you say behind 7.
It was above 7. So 7, it's huge. It's way up into the high atmosphere of this massive cloud that looks like a nuclear device.
Now you're talking about the south side. Now I have an echo again.
No, I'm talking about building 7.
Yeah, but the south side of 7. From Jersey.
Yeah, it would be from Jersey. Yeah.
The voice is doubling up again.
We have to wait. Now it's better. Okay. So, Duane,
yes.
You're claiming that there is a video of Building 7 collapsing, taken from the south. Because if you view it from Jersey, you would watch in between, actually, I can't believe this, because it would be engulfed in the dust from the Twin Towers and the fires from Ground Zero. You cannot see anything from Jersey of 7, but I'm very curious about this. And you have...
Yeah, I... Yeah, I'll look it up. I've got it somewhere in my data, on my hard drive.
Yeah, I guess I do. Neil, from what you've learned, would you think that it would be more likely that that the operatives that actually did 9/11 as far as the World Trade Center part goes, were government operatives or national security operatives, or were did they have to reach out and hire people like Controlled Demolition Incorporated or something like that?
Well, I'd be happy to answer this, but maybe we have to take 15 minutes break to get rid of the echo.
Okay.